At that point, we simply tell him we want down. He'll see to it. He slipped her naked breasts into the wide V of the open shirt, bent, and molded his lips around the stem of a nipple. It was hard and erect. He slipped his tongue slowly back and forth across it in a way he knew she liked. Wendy moaned a little and arched her back.
Something I've forgotten?
Honey? She asked. On their own, her hands sought the back of his head so that when he answered, his voice was muffled against her flesh.
How would the ranger take us out?
He raised his head slightly to answer and then settled his mouth against the other nipple. If the helicopter was spoken for, I guess it would have to be by snowmobile.
But we have one of those. Ullman said so.
His mouth froze against her breast for a moment, and then he sat up. Her own face was slightly flushed, her eyes overbright. Jack's, on the other hand, was calm, as if he had been reading a rather dull book instead of engaging in foreplay with his wife.
If there's a snowmobile, there's no problem, she said excitedly. We can all three go down together.
Wendy, I've never driven a snowmobile in my life.
It can't be that hard to learn. Back in Vermont, you see 10-year-olds driving them in the fields, although what their parents can be thinking of, I don't know. And you had a motorcycle when we met.
He had, a Honda 350cc. He had traded it in on a Saab shortly after he and Wendy took up residence together.
I suppose I could, he said slowly, but I wonder how well it's been maintained.
Ullman and Watson, they run this place from May to October. They have summertime mines. I know it won't have gas in it. There may not be plugs or a battery either. I don't want you to get your hopes up over your head, Wendy. She was totally excited now, leaning over him, her breasts tumbling out of her shirt. He had a sudden impulse to seize one and twist it until she shrieked. Maybe that would teach her to shut up.
The gas is no problem, she said. The VW and the hotel truck are both full. There's gas for the emergency generator downstairs, too. And there must be a gas can out in that shed, so you could carry extra.
Yes, he said, there is. Actually, there were three of them. 2 5-gallons and a 2-gallon.
I'll bet the spark plugs and the battery are out there, too. Nobody would store their snowmobile in one place and the plugs and battery someplace else, would they?
Doesn't seem likely, does it? He got up and walked over to where Danny lay sleeping. A spill of hair had fallen across his forehead, and Jack brushed it away gently. Danny didn't stir.
And if you can get it running, you'll take us out? She asked from behind him. On the first day the radio says good weather?
For a moment, he didn't answer. He stood looking down at his son, and his mixed feelings dissolved in a wave of love. He was the way she had said, vulnerable, fragile. The marks on his neck were very prominent. Yes, he said. I'll get it running, and we'll get out as quick as we can.
Thank God.
He turned around. She had taken off her shirt and lay on the bed, her belly flat, her breasts aimed perkily at the ceiling. She was playing with them lazily, flicking at the nipples.
Hurry up, gentlemen, she said softly. Time.
After, with no light burning in the room but the nightlight that Danny had brought with him from his room, she lay in the crook of his arm, feeling deliciously at peace. She found it hard to believe they could be sharing the overlook with a murderous stowaway.
Jack?
Hmm?
What got at him?
He didn't answer her directly.
He does have something. Some talent the rest of us are missing. The most of us, beg pardon.
And maybe the Overlook has something, too.
Ghosts?
I don't know. Not in the Algernon Blackwood sense, that's for sure. More like the residues of the feelings of the people who have stayed here. Good things and bad things. In that sense, I suppose that every big hotel has got its ghosts. Especially the old ones.
But a dead woman in the tub? Jack, he's not losing his mind, is he?
He gave her a brief squeeze. We know he goes into, well, trances, for want of a better word, from time to time. We know that when he's in them, he sometimes sees things he doesn't understand. If precognitive trances are possible, they're probably functions of the subconscious mind. Freud said that the subconscious never speaks to us in literal language, only in symbols. If you dream about being in a bakery where no one speaks English, you may be worried about your ability to support your family, or maybe just that no one understands you. I've read that the falling dream is a standard outlet for feelings of insecurity. Games. Little games. Conscious on one side of the net, subconscious on the other, serving some cockamamie image back and forth. Same with mental illness, with hunches, all of that. Why should precognition be any different?
Maybe Danny really did see blood all over the walls of the presidential suite. To a kid his age, the image of blood and the concept of death are nearly interchangeable. To kids, the image is always more accessible than the concept anyway. William Carlos Williams knew that. He was a pediatrician. When we grow up, concepts gradually get easier, and we leave the images to the poets. And I'm just rambling on.
I like to hear you ramble.
She said it, folks. She said it. You all heard it.
The marks on his neck, Jack, those are real.
Yes. There was nothing else for a long time. She had begun to think he must have gone to sleep, and she was slipping into a drowse herself when he said, "I can think of two explanations for those, and neither of them involves a fourth party in the hotel."
"What?"
She came up on one elbow.
"Stigmata, maybe," he said. "Stigmata? Isn't that when people bleed on Good Friday or something?"
"Yes. Sometimes people who believe deeply in Christ's divinity exhibit bleeding marks on their hands and feet during the Holy Week. It was more common in the Middle Ages than now. In those days, such people were considered blessed by God. I don't think the Catholic Church proclaimed any of it as out-and-out miracles, which was pretty smart of them. Stigmata isn't much different from some of the things the yogis can do. It's better understood now, that's all. The people who understand the interaction between the mind and the body, study it, I mean, no one understands it, believe we have a lot more control over our involuntary functions than they used to think. You can slow your heartbeat if you think about it enough, speed up your own metabolism, make yourself sweat more, or make yourself bleed.
You think Danny thought those bruises onto his neck? Jack, I just can't believe that.
I can believe it's possible, although it seems unlikely to me, too. What's more likely is that he did it to himself.
To himself?
He's gone into these trances and hurt himself in the past. Do you remember the time at the supper table? About 2 years ago, I think. We were super pissed at each other, nobody talking very much. Then all at once his eyes rolled up in his head and he went face first into his dinner, then onto the floor, remember?
Yes, she said, I sure do. I thought he was having a convulsion.
Another time we were in the park, he said, just Danny and I, Saturday afternoon. He was sitting on a swing, coasting back and forth. He collapsed onto the ground. It was like he'd been shot. I ran over and picked him up, and all of a sudden he just came around. He sort of blinked at me and said, "I hurt my tummy. Tell Mommy to close the bedroom windows if it rains." And that night, it rained like hell.
Yes, but...
And he's always coming in with cuts and scraped elbows. His shins look like a battlefield in distress. And when you ask him how he got this one or that one, he just says, "Oh, I was playing, and that's the end of it."
Jack, all kids get bumped and bruised up.
With little boys, it's almost constant from the time they learn to walk until they're 12 or 13.
"And I'm sure Danny gets his share," Jack responded. "He's an active kid. But I remember that day in the park, and that night at the supper table. And I wonder if some of our kids' bumps and bruises come from just keeling over.
That Dr. Edmonds said Danny did it right in his office, for Christ's sake."
"All right, but those bruises were fingers. I'd swear to it. He didn't get them falling down."
"He goes into a trance," Jack said. "Maybe he sees something that happened in that room, an argument, maybe a suicide, violent emotions. It isn't like watching a movie. He's in a highly suggestible state. He's right in the damn thing. His subconscious is maybe visualizing whatever happened in a symbolic way, as a dead woman who's alive again, zombie, undead, ghoul, you pick your term."
"You're giving me goosebumps," she said thickly.
"I'm giving myself a few. I'm no psychiatrist, but it seems to fit so well. The walking dead woman is a symbol for dead emotions, dead lives that just won't give up and go away. But because she's a subconscious figure, she's also him. In the trance state, the conscious Danny is submerged. The subconscious figure is pulling the strings." So Danny put his hands around his own neck and,
"Stop," she said. "I get the picture.
I think that's more frightening than having a stranger creeping around the halls, Jack. You can move away from a stranger. You can't move away from yourself.
You're talking about schizophrenia."
"Of a very limited type," he said, but a trifle uneasily, "and of a very special nature. Because he does seem able to read thoughts, and he really does seem to have precognitive flashes from time to time. I can't think of that as mental illness, no matter how hard I try. We all have schizo deposits in us anyway. I think as Danny gets older, he'll get this under control."
"If you're right,
Then it's imperative that we get him out. Whatever he has, this hotel is making it worse.
I wouldn't say that, he objected. If he'd done as he was told, he never would have gone up to that room in the first place. It never would have happened.
My God, Jack. Are you implying that being half-strangled was a fitting punishment for being off-limits?
No. No, of course not.
But no buts, she said, shaking her head violently.
The truth is, we're guessing. We don't have any idea when he might turn a corner and run into one of those
air pockets, one-reel horror movies, whatever they are. We have to get him away.
She laughed a little in the darkness. Next thing we'll be seeing things. Don't talk nonsense, he said. And in the darkness of the room, he saw the hedge lions bunching around the path, no longer flanking it but guarding it, hungry November lions. Cold sweat sprang out on his brow.
You didn't really see anything, did you? She was asking. I mean, when you went up to that room, you didn't see anything?
The lions were gone. Now he saw a pink pastel shower curtain with a dark shape lounging behind it, the closed door, that muffled, hurried thump, and sounds after it that might have been running footsteps, the horrible lurching beat of his own heart as he struggled with the passkey.
Nothing, he said, and that was true.
He had been strung up, not sure of what was happening. He hadn't had a chance to sift through his thoughts for a reasonable explanation concerning the bruises on his son's neck. He had been pretty damn suggestible himself. Hallucinations could sometimes be catching.
And you haven't changed your mind? About the snowmobile, I mean?
His hands clamped into sudden, tight fists.
Stop nagging me,
by his sides. I said I would, didn't I? I will. Now go to sleep. It's been a long, hard day.
And how, she said.
There was a rustle of bedclothes as she turned toward him and kissed his shoulder.
I love you, Jack.
I love you too, he said, but he was only mouthing the words. His hands were still clenched into fists. They felt like rocks on the ends of his arms. The pulse beat prominently in his forehead. She hadn't said a word about what was going to happen to them after they got down, when the party was over. Not one word. It had been Danny this and Danny that, and Jack, I'm so scared. Oh, yes. She was scared of a lot of closet boogeymen and jumping shadows, plenty scared. But there was no lack of real ones, either. When they got down to Sidewinder, they would arrive with $60 and the clothes they stood up in. Not even a car. Even if Sidewinder had a pawn shop, which it didn't, they had nothing to hawk but Wendy's $90 diamond engagement ring and the Sony AM-FM radio. A pawnbroker might give them $20, a kind pawnbroker. There would be no job, not even part-time or seasonal, except maybe shoveling out driveways for $3 a shot. The picture of John Torrance, 30 years old, who had once published in Esquire and who had harbored dreams, not at all unreasonable dreams, he felt, of becoming a major American writer during the next decade, with a shovel from the Sidewinder Western Auto on his shoulder, ringing doorbells. That picture suddenly came to him much more clearly than the hedge lines, and he clenched his fists tighter still, feeling the fingernails sink into his palms and draw blood in mystic quarter-moon shapes. John Torrance, standing in line to change his $60 into food stamps, standing in line again at the Sidewinder Methodist Church to get donated commodities and dirty looks from the locals. John Torrance explaining to Al that they'd just had to leave, had to shut down the boiler, had to leave the Overlook and all it contained open to vandals or thieves on snow machines because, you see, Al, attendez-vous, Al, there are ghosts up there, and they have it in for my boy. Goodbye, Al. Thoughts of Chapter 4, Spring Comes for John Torrance. What then? Whatever then? They might be able to get to the West Coast in the VW, he supposed. A new fuel pump would do it. 50 miles west of here and it was all downhill. You could damn near put the bug in neutral and coast to Utah. On to sunny California, land of oranges and opportunity. A man with his sterling record of alcoholism, student beating, and ghost chasing would undoubtedly be able to write his own ticket. Anything you like. Custodial engineer, swamping out Greyhound buses. The automotive business, washing cars in a rubber suit. The culinary arts, perhaps, washing dishes in a diner. Or possibly a more responsible position, such as pumping gas. A job like that even held the intellectual stimulation of making change
and writing out credit slips. I can give you 25 hours a week at the minimum wage. That was heavy tunes in a year when Wonder Bread went for 60 cents a loaf. Blood had begun to trickle down from his palms, like stigmata, oh yes. He squeezed tighter, savaging himself with pain. His wife was asleep beside him. Why not? There were no problems. He had agreed to take her and Danny away from the big bad boogeyman, and there were no problems. So you see, Al, I thought the best thing to do would be to kill her. The thought rose up from nowhere, naked and unadorned. The urge to tumble her out of bed, naked, bewildered, just beginning to wake up, to pounce on her, seize her neck like the green limb of a young aspen, and to throttle her, thumbs on windpipe, fingers pressing against the top of her spine, jerking her head up, and ramming it back down against the floorboards, again and again, whamming, whacking, smashing, crashing, jitter and jive, baby, shake, rattle, and roll. He would make her take her medicine, every drop, every last bitter drop. He was dimly aware of a muffled noise somewhere, just outside his hot and racing inner world. He looked across the room and Danny was thrashing again, twisting in his bed and rumpling the blankets. The boy was moaning deep in his throat, a small, caged sound. What nightmare? A purple woman, long dead, shambling after him down twisting hotel corridors? Somehow he didn't think so. Something else chased Danny in his dreams. Something worse. The bitter lock of his emotions was broken. He got out of bed and went across to the boy, feeling sick and ashamed of himself. It was Danny he had to think of, not Wendy, not himself. Only Danny. And no matter what shape he wrestled the facts into, he knew in his heart that Danny must be taken out. He straightened the boy's blankets and added the quilt from the foot of the bed. Danny had quieted again now. Jack touched the sleeping forehead, what monsters capering just behind that ridge of bone, and found it warm, but not overly so. And he was sleeping peacefully again. Queer. He got back into bed and tried to sleep. It eluded him. It was so unfair that things should turn out this way. Bad luck seemed to stalk them. They hadn't been able to shake it by coming up here after all. By the time they arrived in Sidewinder tomorrow afternoon, the golden opportunity would have evaporated, gone the way of the blue suede shoe, as an old roommate of his had been wont to say. Consider the difference if they didn't go down, if they could somehow stick it out. The play would get finished. One way or the other, he would tack an ending onto it. His own uncertainty about his characters might add an appealing touch of ambiguity to his original ending. Perhaps it would even make him some money. It wasn't impossible. Even lacking that, Al might well convince the Stovington board to rehire him. He would be on pro, of course, maybe for as long as 3 years. But if he could stay sober and keep writing, he might not have to stay at Stovington for 3 years. Of course, he hadn't cared much for Stovington before. He had felt stifled, buried alive, but that had been an immature reaction. Furthermore, how much could a man enjoy teaching when he went through his first 3 classes with a skull-busting hangover every second or third day? It wouldn't be that way again. He would be able to handle his responsibilities much better. He was sure of it. Somewhere in the midst of that thought, things began to break up, and he drifted down into sleep. His last thought followed him down like a sounding bell. It seemed that he might be able to find peace here, at last, if they would only let him. When he woke up, he was standing in the bathroom of 217. Been walking in my sleep again. Why? No radios to break up here. The bathroom light was on, the room behind him in darkness. The shower curtain was drawn around the long, claw-footed tub. The bath mat beside it was wrinkled and wet. He began to feel afraid, but the very dreamlike quality of his fear told him this was not real. Yet that could not contain the fear. So many things at the Overlook seemed like dreams. He moved across the floor to the tub, not wanting to be helpless to turn his feet back. He flung the curtain open. Lying in the tub, naked, lolling almost weightless in the water, was George Hatfield, a knife stuck in his chest. The water around him was stained a bright pink. George's eyes were closed. His penis floated limply, like kelp. George, he heard himself say. At the word, George's eyes snapped open. They were silver, not human eyes at all. George's hands, fish white, found the sides of the tub, and he pulled himself up to a sitting position. The knife stuck straight out from his chest, equidistantly placed between nipples. The wound was lipless.
You set the timer ahead,
silver-eyed George told him.
No, George, I didn't. I
don't stutter. George was standing now, still fixing him with that inhuman silver glare, but his mouth had drawn back in a dead and grimacing smile. He threw one leg over the porcelain side of the tub. One white and wrinkled foot placed itself on the bath mat.
First you tried to run me over on my bike, and then you set the timer ahead, and then you tried to stab me to death, but I still don't stutter.
George was coming for him, his hands out, the fingers slightly curled. He smelled moldy and wet, like leaves that had been rained on.
It was for your own good, Jack said, backing up. I set it ahead for your own good. Furthermore, I happen to know you cheated on your final composition.
I don't cheat, and I don't stutter. George's hands touched his neck. Jack turned and ran with the floating, weightless slowness that is so common to dreams.
You did! You did cheat!
He screamed in fear and anger as he crossed the darkened bed sitting room.
I'll prove it!
George's hands were on his neck again. Jack's heart swelled with fear until he was sure it would burst. And then at last, his hand curled around the doorknob, and it turned under his hand, and he yanked the door open. He plunged out, not into the second-floor hallway, but into the basement room beyond the arch. The cobwebby light was on. His camp chair, stark and geometrical, stood beneath it. And all around it was a miniature mountain range of boxes and crates and banded bundles of records and invoices and God knew what. Relief surged through him.
I'll find it, he heard himself screaming.
He seized a damp and moldering cardboard box. It split apart in his hands, spilling out a waterfall of yellow flimsies.
It's here somewhere. I will find it.
He plunged his hands deep into the pile of papers and came up with a dry, papery wasp's nest in one hand and a timer in the other. The timer was ticking. Attached to its back was a length of electrical cord. And attached to the other end of the cord was a bundle of dynamite.
Here!
He screamed.
Here, take it!
His relief became absolute triumph. He had done more than escape, George. He had conquered. With these talismanic objects in his hands, George would never touch him again. George would flee in terror. He began to turn so he could confront George, and that was when George's hands settled around his neck, squeezing, stopping his breath, damming up his respiration entirely after one final dragging gasp.
I don't stutter, whispered George from behind him.
He dropped the wasp's nest, and wasps boiled out of it in a furious brown and yellow wave. His lungs were on fire. His wavering sight fell on the timer, and the sense of triumph returned, along with a cresting wave of righteous wrath. Instead of connecting the timer to dynamite, the cord ran to the gold knob of a stout black cane, like the one his father had carried after the accident with the milk truck. He grasped it, and the cord parted. The cane felt heavy and right in his hands. He swung it back over his shoulder. On the way up, it glanced against the wire from which the light bulb depended, and the light began to swing back and forth, making the room's hooded shadows rock monstrously against the floor and walls. On the way down, the cane struck something much harder. George screamed. The grip on Jack's throat loosened. He tore free of George's grip and whirled. George was on his knees, his head drooping, his hands laced together on top of it. Blood welled through his fingers.
Please, George whispered humbly. Give me a break, Mr. Torrance.
Now you'll take your medicine, Jack grunted. Now, by God, won't you, young pup? Young worthless cur? Now, by God, right now, every drop, every single damn drop.
As the light swayed above him and the shadows danced and flapped, he began to swing the cane, bringing it down again and again, his arm rising and falling like a machine. George's bloody, protecting fingers fell away from his head, and Jack brought the cane down again and again, and on his neck and shoulders and back and arms. except that the cane was no longer precisely a cane. It seemed to be a mallet with some kind of brightly striped handle, a mallet with a hard side and soft side. The business end was clotted with blood and hair, and the flat, whacking sound of the mallet against flesh had been replaced with a hollow, booming sound, echoing and reverberating. His own voice had taken on this same quality, bellowing, disembodied. And yet, paradoxically, it sounded weaker, slurred, petulant, as if he were drunk. The figure on its knees slowly raised its head, as if in supplication. There was not a face precisely, but only a mask of blood through which eyes peered. He brought the mallet back for a final, whistling downstroke, and it was fully launched before he saw that the supplicating face below him was not George's, but Danny's. It was the face of his son.
"Daddy."
And then the mallet crashed home, striking Danny right between the eyes, closing them forever. And something somewhere seemed to be laughing.
"No!"
He came out of it, standing naked over Danny's bed, his hands empty, his body sheened with sweat. His final scream had only been in his mind. He voiced it again, this time in a whisper.
"No. No, Danny. Never."
He went back to bed on legs that had turned to rubber. Wendy was sleeping deeply. The clock on the nightstand said it was 4:45. He lay sleepless until 7, when Danny began to stir awake. Then he put his legs over the edge of the bed and began to dress. It was time to go downstairs and check the boiler. 33. The Snowmobile. Sometime after midnight, while they all slept uneasily, the snow had stopped after dumping a fresh 8 inches on the old crust. The clouds had broken, a fresh wind had swept them away, and now Jack stood in a dusty ingot of sunlight, which slanted through the dirty window set into the eastern side of the equipment shed. The place was about as long as a freight car and about as high. It smelled of grease and oil and gasoline and, faint nostalgic smell, sweet grass. 4 power lawnmowers were ranked like soldiers on review against the south wall, 2 of them the riding type that looked like small tractors. To their left were posthole diggers, round-bladed shovels made for doing surgery on the putting green, a chainsaw, the electric hedge clippers, and a long, thin steel pole with a red flag at the top. "Caddy, fetch my ball in under 10 seconds, and there's a quarter in it for you." "Yes, sir." Against the eastern wall, where the morning sun slanted in most strongly, 3 ping-pong tables leaned one against the other like a drunken house of cards. Their nets had been removed and flopped down from the shelf above. In the corner was a stack of shuffleboard weights and a roque set, the wickets banded together with twists of wire, the brightly painted balls in an egg carton sort of thing. "Strange hens you have up here, Watson." "Yes, and you should see the animals down on the front lawn. Ha, ha." And the mallets, 2 sets of them, standing in their racks. He walked over to them, stepping over an old 8-cell battery, which had once sat beneath the hood of the hotel truck, no doubt, and a battery charger and a pair of J.C. Penney jumper cables coiled between them. He slipped one of the short-handled mallets out of the front rack and held it up in front of his face, like a knight bound for battle, saluting his king. Fragments of his dream, it was all jumbled now, fading, recurred. Something about George Hatfield and his father's cane, just enough to make him uneasy, and absurdly enough, a trifle guilty about holding a plain old garden-variety roque mallet. Not that roque was such a common garden-variety game anymore. Its more modern cousin, croquet, was much more popular now, and a child's version of the game at that. Roque, however, that must have been quite a game. Jack had found a mildewed rule book down in the basement, from one of the years in the early 20s when a North American roque tournament had been held at the Overlook. Quite a game. Schizo. He frowned a little, then smiled. Yes, it was a schizo sort of game at that. The mallet expressed that perfectly. A soft end and a hard end. A game of finesse and aim, and a game of raw, bludgeoning power. He swung the mallet through the air. Whoop. He smiled a little at the powerful, whistling sound it made. Then he replaced it in the rack and turned to his left. What he saw there,
made him frown again. The snowmobile sat almost in the middle of the equipment shed, a fairly new one, and Jack didn't care for its looks at all. "Bombardier Skidoo" was written on the side of the engine cowling facing him in black letters which had been raked backward, presumably to connote speed. The protruding skis were also black. There was black piping to the right and left of the cowling, what they would call racing stripes on a sports car. But the actual paint job was a bright, sneering yellow, and that was what he didn't like about it. Sitting there, in its shaft of morning sun, yellow body and black piping, black skis and black upholstered open cockpit, it looked like a monstrous, mechanized wasp. When it was running, it would sound like that, too. Whining and buzzing and ready to sting. But then, what else should it look like? It wasn't flying under false colors, at least. Because after it had done its job, they were going to be hurting plenty. All of them. By spring, the Torrance family would be hurting so badly that what those wasps had done to Danny's hand would look like a mother's kisses. He pulled his handkerchief from his back pocket, wiped his mouth with it, and walked over to the Skidoo. He stood looking down at it, the frown very deep now, and stuffed his handkerchief back into his pocket. Outside, a sudden gust of wind slammed against the equipment shed, making it rock and creak. He looked out the window and saw the gust carrying a sheet of sparkling snow crystals toward the drifted-in rear of the hotel, whirling them high into the hard blue sky. The wind dropped, and he went back to looking at the machine. It was a disgusting thing, really. You almost expected to see a long, limber stinger protruding from the rear of it. He had always disliked the goddamn snowmobiles. They shivered the cathedral silence of winter into a million rattling fragments. They startled the wildlife. They sent out huge and pollutive clouds of blue and billowing oil smoke behind them. Cough, cough, gag, gag, let me breathe. They were perhaps the final grotesque toy of the unwinding fossil fuel age, given to 10-year-olds for Christmas. He remembered a newspaper article he had read in Stovington, a story datelined someplace in Maine. A kid on a snowmobile, barrel-assing up a road he'd never traveled before at better than 30 miles an hour. Night, his headlight off. There had been a heavy chain strung between two posts, with a no trespassing sign hung from the middle. They said that in all probability, the kid never saw it. The moon might have gone behind a cloud. The chain had decapitated him. Reading the story, Jack had been almost glad. And now, looking down at this machine, the feeling recurred. If it wasn't for Danny, I would take great pleasure in grabbing one of those mallets, opening the cowling, and just pounding until... He let his pent-up breath escape him in a long, slow sigh. Wendy was right. Come hell, high water, or the welfare line, Wendy was right. Pounding this machine to death would be the height of folly, no matter how pleasant an aspect that folly made. It would almost be tantamount to pounding his own son to death. Fucking Luddite, he said aloud. He went to the back of the machine and unscrewed the gas cap. He found a dipstick on one of the shelves that ran at chest height around the walls and slipped it in. The last eighth of an inch came out wet. Not very much, but enough to see if the damn thing would run. Later he could siphon more from the Volks in the hotel truck. He screwed the cap back on and opened the cowling. No spark plugs. No battery. He went to the shelf again and began to poke along it, pushing aside screwdrivers and adjustable wrenches, a one-lung carburetor that had been taken out of an old lawnmower, plastic boxes of screws and nails and bolts of varying sizes. The shelf was thick and dark with old grease, and the year's accumulation of dust had stuck to it like fur. He didn't like touching it. He found a small, oil-stained box with the abbreviation SKID laconically marked on it in pencil. He shook it, and something rattled inside. Plugs. He held one of them up to the light, trying to estimate the gap without hunting around for the gapping tool. Fuck it, he thought resentfully, and dropped the plug back into the box. If the gap's wrong, that's just too damn bad. Tough fucking titty. There was a stool behind the door. He dragged it over, sat down, and installed the four spark plugs, then fitted the small rubber caps over each. That done, he let his fingers play briefly over the magneto. They laughed when I sat down at the piano. Back to the shelves.
This time he couldn't find what he wanted, a small battery, a 3 or 4 cell. There were socket wrenches, a case filled with drills and drill bits, bags of lawn fertilizer and Vigoro for the flower beds. But no snowmobile battery. It didn't bother him in the slightest. In fact, it made him feel glad. He was relieved.
I did my best, Captain, but I could not get through. That's fine, son. I'm going to put you in for the Silver Star and the Purple Snowmobile. You're a credit to your regiment.
Thank you, sir. I did try. He began to whistle Red River Valley up-tempo as he poked along the last 2 or 3 feet of shelf. The notes came out in little puffs of white smoke. He had made a complete circuit of the shed, and the thing wasn't there. Maybe somebody had lifted it. Maybe Watson had. He laughed aloud. The old office bootleg trick. A few paper clips, a couple of reams of paper. Nobody will miss this tablecloth or this golden regal place setting. And what about this fine snowmobile battery? Yes, that might come in handy. Toss it in the sack. White-collar crime, baby. Everybody has sticky fingers. Under-the-jacket discount, we used to call it when we were kids.
He walked back to the snowmobile and gave the side of it a good, healthy kick as he went by. Well, that was the end of it. He would just have to tell Wendy, "Sorry, baby, but..."
There was a box sitting in the corner by the door. The stool had been right over it. Written on the top in pencil was the abbreviation SKID. He looked at it, the smile drying up on his lips.
"Look, sir, it's the cavalry. Looks like your smoke signals must have worked after all."
It wasn't fair. God damn it, it just wasn't fair. Something, luck, fate, providence, had been trying to save him. Some other luck. White luck. And at the last moment, bad old Jack Torrance luck had stepped back in. The lousy run of cards wasn't over yet. Resentment, a gray, sullen wave of it, pushed up his throat. His hands had clenched into fists again. Not fair, goddammit, not fair. Why couldn't he have looked someplace else, any place? Why hadn't he had a crick in his neck or an itch in his nose or the need to blink? Just one of those little things. He never would have seen it. Well, he hadn't. That was all. It was an hallucination, no different from what had happened yesterday outside that room on the second floor or the goddamn hedge menagerie. A momentary strain, that was all. Fancy, I thought I saw a snowmobile battery in that corner. Nothing there now. Combat fatigue, I guess, sir. Sorry. Keep your pecker up, son. It happens to all of us sooner or later. He yanked the door open almost hard enough to snap the hinges and pulled his snowshoes inside. They were clotted with snow, and he slapped them down hard enough on the floor to raise a cloud of it. He put his left foot on the left shoe and paused. Danny was out there, by the milk platform, trying to make a snowman by the looks. Not much luck. The snow was too cold to stick together. Still, he was giving it the old college try, out there in the flashing morning, a speck of a bundled-up boy, above the brilliant snow and below the brilliant sky, wearing his hat turned around backward, like Carlton Fisk. "What in the name of God were you thinking of?" The answer came back with no pause. "Me. I was thinking of me." He suddenly remembered lying in the bed the night before, lying there, and suddenly he had been contemplating the murder of his wife. In that instant, kneeling there, everything came clear to him. It was not just Danny the Overlook was working on. It was working on him, too. It wasn't Danny who was the weak link. It was him. He was the vulnerable one, the one who could be bent and twisted until something snapped. "Until I let go and sleep, and when I do that, if I do that..." He looked up at the banks of windows, and the sun threw back an almost blinding glare from their many-paned surfaces, but he looked anyway. For the first time he noticed how much they seemed like eyes. They reflected away the sun and held their own darkness within. It was not Danny they were looking at. It was him. In those few seconds, he understood everything. There was a certain black-and-white picture he remembered seeing as a child, in catechism class. The nun had presented it to them on an easel and called it a miracle of God. The class had looked at it blankly, seeing nothing but a jumble of whites and blacks, senseless and patternless. Then one of the children in the third row had gasped, "It's Jesus!" And that child had gone home with a brand new testament and also a calendar, because he had been first. The others stared even harder, Jackie Torrance among them. One by one, the other kids had given a similar gasp, one little girl transported in near ecstasy, crying out shrilly, "I see him! I see him!" She had also been rewarded with a testament. At last, everyone had seen the face of Jesus in the jumble of blacks and whites, except Jackie. He strained harder and harder, scared now, part of him cynically thinking that everyone else was simply putting on to please Sister Beatrice, part of him secretly convinced that he wasn't seeing it because God had decided he was the worst sinner in the class. "Don't you see it, Jackie?" Sister Beatrice had asked him in her sad, sweet manner. "I see your tits," he had thought, in vicious desperation. He began to shake his head, then faked excitement and said, "Yes, I do. Wow, it is Jesus." And everyone in class had laughed and applauded him, making him feel triumphant, ashamed, and scared. Later, when everyone else had tumbled their way up from the church basement and out onto the street, he had lingered behind, looking at the meaningless black-and-white jumble that Sister Beatrice had left on the easel. He hated it. They had all made it up the way he had, even Sister herself. It was a big fake. "Shitfire, hellfire, shitfire," he had whispered under his breath, and as he turned to go, he had seen the face of Jesus from the corner of his eye, sad and wise. He turned back, his heart in his throat. Everything had suddenly clicked into place, and he had stared at the picture with fearful wonder, unable to believe he had missed it. The eyes, the zigzag of shadow across the careworn brow, the fine nose, the compassionate lips. Looking at Jackie Torrance. What had only been a meaningless sprawl had suddenly been transformed into a stark, black-and-white etching of the face of Christ our Lord. Fearful wonder became terror. He had cussed in front of a picture of Jesus. He would be damned. He would be in hell with the sinners. The face of Christ had been in the picture all along. All along. Now, kneeling in the sun, and watching his son playing in the shadow of the hotel, he knew that it was all true. The hotel wanted Danny. Maybe all of them, but Danny for sure. The Hedges had really walked. There was a dead woman in 217, a woman that was perhaps only a spirit and harmless under most circumstances, but a woman who was now an active danger. Like some malevolent clockwork toy, she had been wound up and set in motion by Danny's own odd mind, and his own. Had it been Watson, who had told him a man had dropped dead of a stroke one day on the Roque Court? Or had it been Ullman? It didn't matter. There had been an assassination on the third floor. How many old quarrels, suicides, strokes? How many murders? Was Grady lurking somewhere in the West Wing with his axe, just waiting for Danny to start him up so he could come back out of the woodwork? The puffed circle of bruises around Danny's neck. The twinkling, half-seen bottles in the deserted lounge. The radio. The dreams. The scrapbook he had found in the cellar. "Medoc, are you here? I've been sleepwalking again, my dear." He got up suddenly, thrusting the snowshoes back out the door. He was shaking all over. He slammed the door and picked up the box with the battery in it. It slipped through his shaking fingers. Oh, Christ, what if I cracked it? And thumped over on its side. He pulled the flaps of the carton open and yanked the battery out, heedless of the acid that might be leaking through the battery's casing if it had cracked. But it hadn't. It was whole. A little sigh escaped his lips. Cradling it, he took it over to the skidoo and put it on its platform near the front of the engine. He found a small adjustable wrench on one of the shelves and attached the battery cables quickly and with no trouble. The battery was live. No need to use the charger on it. There had been a crackle of electricity and a small odor of ozone when he slipped the positive cable onto its terminal. The job done, he stood away, wiping his hands nervously on his faded denim jacket. There. It should work. No reason why not. No reason at all except that it was part of the Overlook, and the Overlook really didn't want them out of here. Not at all. The Overlook was having one hell of a good time. There was a little boy to terrorize, a man and his woman to set one against the other. And if it played its cards right, they could end up flitting through the Overlook's halls like insubstantial shades in a Shirley Jackson novel, whatever walked in Hill House walked alone, but you wouldn't be alone in the Overlook, oh no. There would be plenty of company here. but there was really no reason why the snowmobile shouldn't start. Except, of course, except he still didn't really want to go. Yes, except for that. He stood looking at the skidoo, his breath puffing out in frozen little plumes. He wanted it to be the way it had been. When he had come in here, he'd had no doubts. Going down would be the wrong decision. He had known that then. Wendy was only scared of the boogeyman, summoned up by a single, hysterical little boy. Now suddenly he could see her side. It was like his play, his damnable play. He no longer knew which side he was on, or how things should come out. Once you saw the face of a god in those jumbled blacks and whites, it was everybody out of the pool. You could never unsee it. Others might laugh and say it's nothing, just a lot of splotches with no meaning. Give me a good old craftmaster paint by the numbers any day, but you would always see the face of Christ our Lord looking out at you. You had seen it in one gestalt leap, the conscious and unconscious melding in that one shocking moment of understanding. You would always see it. You were damned to always see it.
I've been sleepwalking again, my dear.
It had been all right until he had seen Danny playing in the snow. It was Danny's fault. Everything had been Danny's fault. He was the one with the shining or whatever it was. It wasn't a shining. It was a curse. If he and Wendy had been here alone, they could have passed the winter quite nicely. No pain, no strain on the brain.
Don't want to leave? Can't?
The Overlook didn't want them to go, and he didn't want them to go either. Not even Danny. Maybe he was a part of it now. Perhaps the Overlook, large and rambling Samuel Johnson that it was, had picked him to be its Boswell. You say the new caretaker writes? Very good. Sign him on. Time we told our side. Let's get rid of the woman and his snot-nosed kid first, however. We don't want him to be distracted. We don't. He was standing by the snowmobile's cockpit, his head starting to ache again. What did it come down to? Go or stay. Very simple. Keep it simple. Shall we go, or shall we stay? If we go, how long will it be before you find the local hole in Sidewinder? A voice inside him asked. The dark place with the lousy color TV that unshaven and unemployed men spend the day watching game shows on? Where the piss in the men's room smells 2,000 years old, and there's always a sodden camel butt unraveling in the toilet bowl? Where the beer is 30 cents a glass and you cut it with salt, and the jukebox is loaded with 70 country oldies? How long? Oh, Christ. He was so afraid it wouldn't be long at all. I can't win, he said, very softly. That was it. He was like trying to play solitaire, with one of the aces missing from the deck. Abruptly, he leaned over the skidoo's motor compartment and yanked off the magneto. It came off with sickening ease. He looked at it for a moment, then went to the equipment shed's back door and opened it. From here, the view of the mountains was unobstructed, picture postcard beautiful in the twinkling brightness of morning. An unbroken field of snow rose to the first pines about a mile distant. He flung the magneto as far out into the snow as he could. It went much further than it should have. There was a light puff of snow when it fell. The light breeze carried the snow granules away to fresh resting places. Disperse there, I say. There's nothing to see. It's all over. Disperse. He felt at peace. He stood in the doorway for a long time, breathing the good mountain air, and then he closed it firmly and went back out the other door to tell Wendy they would be staying. On the way, he stopped and had a snowball fight with Danny. 34. The Hedges. It was November 29th, 3 days after Thanksgiving. The last week had been a good one, the Thanksgiving dinner the best they'd ever had as a family. Wendy had cooked Dick Halloran's turkey to a turn, and they had all eaten to bursting without even coming close to demolishing the jolly bird. Jack had groaned that they would be eating turkey for the rest of the winter. Creamed turkey, turkey sandwiches, turkey and noodles, turkey surprise. No, Wendy told him with a little smile, only until Christmas. Then we have the capon. Jack and Danny groaned together. The bruises on Danny's neck had faded, and their fears seemed to have faded with them. On Thanksgiving afternoon, Wendy had been pulling Danny around on his sled while Jack worked on the play, which was now almost done.
"Are you still afraid, Doc?"
she had asked, not knowing how to put the question less baldly.
"Yes,"
he answered simply, "but now I stay in the safe places."
"Your daddy says that sooner or later the forest rangers will wonder why we're not checking in on the CB radio. They'll come to see if anything is wrong. We might go down then, you and I, and let your daddy finish the winter. He has good reasons for wanting to."
"In a way, Doc, I know this is hard for you to understand. Our backs are against the wall."
"Yes,"
he had answered noncommittally. On this sparkling afternoon, the two of them were upstairs, and Danny knew that they had been making love. They were dozing now. They were happy, he knew. His mother was still a little bit afraid, but his father's attitude was strange. It was a feeling that he had done something that was very hard, and had done it right. But Danny could not seem to see exactly what the something was. His father was guarding that carefully, even in his own mind. Was it possible, Danny wondered, to be glad you had done something, and still be so ashamed of that something that you tried not to think of it? The question was a disturbing one. He didn't think such a thing was possible in a normal mind. His hardest probings at his father had only brought him a dim picture of something like an octopus whirling up into the hard blue sky. And on both occasions that he had concentrated hard enough to get this, Daddy had suddenly been staring at him in a sharp and frightening way, as if he knew what Danny was doing. Now he was in the lobby, getting ready to go out. He went out a lot, taking his sled or wearing his snowshoes. He liked to get out of the hotel. When he was out in the sunshine, it seemed like a weight had slipped from his shoulders. He pulled a chair over, stood on it, and got his parka and snow pants out of the ballroom closet, and then sat down on the chair to put them on. His boots were in the boot box, and he pulled them on, his tongue creeping out into the corner of his mouth in concentration as he laced them and tied the rawhide into careful granny knots. He pulled on his mittens and his ski mask and was ready. He tramped out through the kitchen to the back door, then paused. He was tired of playing out back, and at this time of day the hotel's shadow would be cast over his play area. He didn't even like being in the overlook's shadow. He decided he would put on his snowshoes and go down to the playground instead. Dick Halloran had told him to stay away from the topiary, but the thought of the hedge animals did not bother him much. They were buried under snowdrifts now, nothing showing but a vague hump that was the rabbit's head and the lion's tails. Sticking out of the snow the way they were, the tails looked more absurd than frightening. Danny opened the back door and got his snowshoes from the milk platform. 5 minutes later, he was strapping them to his feet on the front porch. His daddy had told him that he, Danny, had the hang of using the snowshoes, the lazy, shuffling stride, the twist of ankle that shook the powdery snow from the lacings just before the boot came back down, and all that remained was for him to build up the necessary muscles in his thighs and calves and ankles. Danny found that his ankles got tired the fastest. Snowshoeing was almost as hard on your ankles as skating because you had to keep clearing the lacings. Every 5 minutes or so he had to stop with his legs spread and the snowshoes flat on the snow to rest them. But he didn't have to rest on his way down to the playground because it was all downhill. Less than 10 minutes up and over the monstrous snow dune that had drifted in on the overlook's front porch, he was standing with his mittened hand on the playground slide. He wasn't even breathing hard. The playground seemed much nicer in the deep snow than it ever had during the autumn. It looked like a fairyland sculpture. The swing chains had been frozen in strange positions, the seats of the big kid swings resting flush against the snow. The jungle gym was an ice cave guarded by dripping icicle teeth. Only the chimneys of the play overlook stuck up over the snow. Wish the other one was buried that way, only not with us in it. And the tops of the cement rings protruded in two places, like Eskimo igloos. Danny tramped over there, squatted, and began to dig. Before long he had uncovered the dark mouth of one of them, and he slipped into the cold tunnel. In his mind, he was Patrick McGoohan, the secret agent man. They had shown the reruns of that program twice on the Burlington TV channel, and his daddy never missed them. He would skip a party to stay home and watch Secret Agent or the Avengers, and Danny had always watched with him. On the run from KGB agents in the mountains of Switzerland. There had been avalanches in the area, and the notorious KGB agent Slabo had killed his girlfriend with a poisoned dart, but somewhere near was the Russian anti-gravity machine. Perhaps at the end of this very tunnel. He drew his automatic and went along the concrete tunnel, his eyes wide and alert, his breath pluming out. The far end of the concrete ring was solidly blocked with snow. He tried digging through it, and was amazed and a little uneasy to see how solid it was, almost like ice from the cold and the constant weight of more snow on top of it. His make-believe game collapsed around him, and he was suddenly aware that he felt closed in and extremely nervous in this tight ring of cement. He could hear his breathing. It sounded dank and quick and hollow. He was under the snow, and hardly any light filtered down the hole he had dug to get in here. Suddenly he wanted to be out in the sunlight more than anything. Suddenly he remembered his daddy and mommy were sleeping and didn't know where he was, that if the hole he dug caved in, he would be trapped, and the overlook didn't like him. Danny got turned around with some difficulty and crawled back along the length of the concrete ring, his snowshoes clacking woodenly together behind him, his palms crackling in last fall's dead aspen leaves beneath him. He had just reached the end, and the cold spill of light coming down from above when the snow did give in. A minor fall, but enough to powder his face and clog the opening he had wriggled down through and leave him in darkness. For a moment, his brain froze in utter panic, and he could not think. Then, as if from far off, he heard his daddy telling him that he must never play at the Stovington dump, because sometimes stupid people hauled old refrigerators off to the dump without removing the doors, and if you got in one and the door happened to shut on you, there was no way to get out. You would die in the darkness. You wouldn't want a thing like that to happen to you, would you, Doc? No, Daddy. But it had happened, his frenzied mind told him. It had happened. He was in the dark. He was closed in, and it was as cold as a refrigerator. And something is in here with me. His breath stopped in a gasp. An almost drowsy terror stole through his veins. Yes. Yes, there was something in here with him. Some awful thing the Overlook had saved for just such a chance as this. Maybe a huge spider that had burrowed down under the dead leaves, or a rat. Or maybe the corpse of some little kid that had died here on the playground. Had that ever happened? Yes, he thought maybe it had. He thought of the woman in the tub, the blood and brains on the wall of the presidential suite. Of some little kid, its head split open from a fall from the monkey bars or a swing, crawling after him in the dark, grinning, looking for one final playmate in its endless playground, forever. In a moment he would hear it coming. At the far end of the concrete ring, Danny heard the stealthy crackle of dead leaves as something came for him on its hands and knees. At any moment, he would feel its cold hand close over his ankle. That thought broke his paralysis. He was digging at the loose fall of snow that choked the end of the concrete ring, throwing it back between his legs in powdery bursts like a dog digging for a bone. Blue light filtered down from above, and Danny thrust himself up at it like a diver coming out of deep water. He scraped his back on the lip of the concrete ring. One of his snowshoes twisted behind the other, snow spilled down inside his ski mask and into the collar of his parka. He dug at the snow, clawed at it. It seemed to be trying to hold him, to suck him back down, back into the concrete ring where that unseen, leaf-crackling thing was, and keep him there. Forever. Then he was out. His face was turned up to the sun, and he was crawling through the snow, crawling away from the half-buried cement ring, gasping harshly, his face almost comically white with powdered snow, a living fright mask. He hobbled over to the jungle gym and sat down to readjust his snowshoes and get his breath. As he set them to rights and tightened the straps again, he never took his eyes from the hole at the end of the concrete ring. He waited to see if something would come out. Nothing did, and after 3 or 4 minutes, Danny's breathing began to slow down. Whatever it was, it couldn't stand the sunlight. It was cooped up down there, maybe only able to come out when it was dark, or when both ends of its circular prison were plugged with snow. But I'm safe now. I'm safe. I'll just go back, because now I'm... Something thumped softly behind him. He turned around toward the hotel and looked. But even before he looked, can you see the Indians in this picture? He knew what he would see, because he knew what that soft thumping sound had been. It was the sound of a large clump of snow falling, the way it sounded when it slid off the roof of the hotel and fell to the ground. Can you see? Yes,
He could. The snow had fallen off the hedge dog. When he came down, it had only been a harmless lump of snow outside the playground. Now it stood revealed,